Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. For the first time ever, a spacecraft has landed on the far side of the moon, the side that you and I never see because it never faces the Earth. But it wasn't America that achieved this exploration milestone. It was China, taking another giant leap in their effort to travel further and further into space. Joining me now via Skype to talk about this, along with other space-related milestones this week, is Kelly Beatty, senior contributing editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Evan.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing really well, and I'm really excited to talk about space, something non-political for a few minutes. I'm really eager for this. Tell me about this far side landing. How big a deal is this?
Well, it's a pretty big deal in the sense that it's a first. You know, the Chinese have expressed an aggressive plan for exploring the moon. They sent their first orbiter there in 2007. This next phase is to set down landers. There was one previously on the near side. This one on the far side is new and different. And then eventually, beginning at the end of this year, they're going to launch spacecraft to grab samples and bring them back. What makes this so interesting, apart from being on the far side, is where they set it down. It's in this huge impact basin on the far side of the moon we can't see, called the South Pole Aitken Basin. And when this thing was gouged out of the backside of the moon in ancient times, at least 3 billion years ago, it dug down deep enough into the moon that it might have even exposed a little bit of the moon's mantle. And so this is why it's such an interesting place to land.
I mean, can we actually back up a step? Maybe I should have asked this first. Why is there a side of the moon that we can't see? I mean, it's spinning, right? We're spinning. Right. It's spinning. Presumably, we should be able to see everything.
At the same rate, and that's the key. The moon spins exactly once every time it goes around the Earth. And this is a kind of a locked-in situation that forces one hemisphere of the moon to face us all the time.
Is that like a coincidence, or is this a kind of a mathematical inevitability?
It's because Earth is a big planet with a lot of gravity, at least at these ranges. And so over time, the moon became locked into this by the Earth's gravitational pull. And, ever since time immemorial, since the moon's formation, it's been this way.
I mean, it's just kind of crazy because I don't know. Maybe I should have known that, but it never occurred to me that I only look at the same side of the moon. But we've seen pictures. Like, I imagine you're saying this is the first time someone's landed on that side, but we've had orbiting spacecraft that have taken pictures and whatnot, so they knew what to look for when they were making this landing.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, it was a dramatic time back in the 1960s when the Soviet Union sent the first spacecraft past the moon to take photos of this backside. Until then, we had no idea what it looked like. Now it's pretty routine. NASA has a terrific spacecraft called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is sending back pictures of this far side every day.
The other thing that's crazy, now that I think about it, they have a spacecraft on the far side. That far side spacecraft can't communicate directly with Earth, right? Because the moon's in the way.
You are very, very perceptive. And what the Chinese did that was so novel is ahead of time, they launched a relay satellite, which is in a kind of halo orbit well beyond the moon that can both see the lander and see the Earth at the same time. So it's able to relay the signals and the pictures that we've already received from this lander, Chang'e 4, which landed just yesterday.
So how should we think about the relationship between the American space program and the Chinese space program? I mean, are we building on each other's successes? Do we win when the Chinese enhance their exploratory capacity? Or is this a competitive endeavor that we can't afford to lose?
Well, scientifically, we definitely benefit. We've gotten to the point where space travel, especially to other places, has gotten so expensive that we kind of need to share the burden. And so the fact that the Chinese are doing that adds to our scientific body of knowledge. The thing that's going on here, though, is that China is sort of at the stage, even though they're being aggressive, they're kind of at the stage where the United States and the Soviet Union was, say, three decades ago in the 70s and 80s. And so they're catching up quickly. They have, they have a spacecraft carrying crews and a rudimentary space station. The thing that we need to know more about is the parallel spacecraft, the military space program that the Chinese are building, and what kind of capability that has. Just like the Soviets in years past, the Chinese have been very secretive. It's not something that we know a lot about.
Because there could be dual-purpose activities, military, civilian.
Sure. Just NASA and our programs have been the same way. As we develop technologies that allow us to go into space, you can use it for civilian and scientific good, and you can use it for military purposes as well.
All right. Well, let's talk about something that the U.S. space program is doing, and that is Ultima Thule. Did I get that right?
Very good.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is the most distant object we've ever gotten close to, beyond Pluto, at the edge of the solar system. You were, I gather you were in mission control in Maryland to see the first image of it come through on New Year's Eve. Is that right?
Well, the flyby happened on New Year's Eve at about a half an hour past midnight. It was a pretty bizarre New Year's Eve party I was at with hundreds of my scientific best friends. The first images from that trickled back in the few days since then, and we now have a pretty good idea. This is a really bizarre object. It's actually, think of two bowling balls stuck together, kind of like a snowman, and it turns out that this is a pretty common structure in that part of the solar system. Roughly 30% of the objects that we know of beyond Neptune, out in what's called the Kuiper Belt, have this kind of binary nature, and it's telling us something key about how the solar system formed, because this stuff out there so far has been largely undisturbed, if not completely undisturbed, since the beginning of our solar system 4.5 billion years ago.
That's an incredible amount of time. I mean, the other thing that's incredible amount of time, you just told the story. You were at the party, but the images came back days later. It takes a long time to communicate with this spacecraft out in the Kuiper Belt. Yeah,
right. It's about 6 hours each way at the speed of light.
The speed of light travels for 6 hours to get there.
That's right. It's more than 4 billion miles away, just to put it in concrete terms. And also, the spacecraft has very limited power on board. Even though it's radioing it back from this big communication dish, the transmitter has only 15 watts of power. So that translates into a kind of a trickle of data. Think of to your old 300 baud modem days. And so it's taking a long time, and will take a long time, 20 months, in fact, to get all of the data back that it gathered in just a few hours when it was closest to this object.
And how cold is it?
Oh, it's within a few tens of degrees of absolute zero, if you can believe it.
So like hundreds of degrees below zero.
Within a few tens of degrees of absolute zero.
Yeah, but right. So I'm trying to remember how far down that is on the scale.
That's like 400 degrees minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly speaking. The sunlight out there is only about 1/2000th as strong as it is here on Earth. So it's a really cold place, and that's a good thing, because this object is probably mostly icy, and those ices hold keys to what our solar system was like when it formed.
So let me ask, just looking ahead now, what exploration should we be attentive to, or what are you most looking forward to in 2019?
Oh, gosh, it's a whole laundry list. So, for example, just within the next month or two, there will be two spacecraft, neither NASA's. One will be India's and the other will be Israel's, if you can believe it, that will be launched toward the moon. There'll be a total eclipse of the moon on the Sunday night of the Martin Luther King weekend. On June 30th, a private spacecraft built by SpaceX will launch astronauts to the International Space Station. That should be a real groundbreaking thing. And I did mention that Chang'e 5 will land on the moon, if launch goes according to plan, in late December and bring back samples.
I guess we have to get our calendars prepared. That's Kelly Beatty, Senior Contributing Editor of Sky and Telescope Magazine. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Evan.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zukoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Evan Horowitz. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.